Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. I am your host, Austin Peterson, here with my colleague, Ian Hewitt. Ian, welcome back to the Freedom Report.
Good to be here.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking today about the fall of Iraq. This article comes from the Washington Post. Insurgents inspired by Al-Qaeda rapidly pressed towards Baghdad on Wednesday, confronting little resistance from Iraq's collapsing security forces and expanding an arc of control that now includes a wide swath of the country. By nightfall, the militants had reached the flashpoint city of Samarra, just 70 miles outside Baghdad, after having first seized Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, and other cities while pressing southward from Mosul. The stunning speed with which the rout has unfolded in northern Iraq has raised deep doubts about the capacity of U.S.-trained security forces, and it has also kindled fears about the government's grip on the capital. In a country already fraught with sectarian tension, with parts of western Iraq already in Sunni militant hands, the latest gains by insurgents from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria prompted cries of alarms from leaders of Iraq's Shiite Muslim majority. It appeared that the militants were facing more robust resistance as they moved south, where Iraq's Shiites have a stronger presence. But several experts said it would be wrong to assume that the heavily fortified Baghdad, with its large Shiite population and concentration of elite forces, could easily fend off an ISIS attack. On Thursday, the militant group vowed to march on to Baghdad. A spokesman for the Islamic State of Iran and the Levant says the group has old scores with the Shiite-led government in Baghdad, the AP reported. The spokesman, Abu Muhammad el-Adnani, also threatened that ISL fighters will take the southern Iraqi Shiite cities of Karbala and Najaf, which hold the two of the holiest shrines for Shiite Muslims. The statement, which could not be independently verified, came in an audio posting Thursday on militant websites. Baghdad is definitely vulnerable, said Raul Alkalka, former U.S. advisor to Iraq's National Security Council. He says there are more troops in Baghdad, but it doesn't mean that it isn't porous. Before the podcast happened, Ian and I were discussing, I asked him the question, I'm like, what's the difference between ISIS and ISIL? And what was your response to that, Ian?
Well, different media outlets are using different acronyms, but they are the same group. I think it's important to talk about this group because it's easy to get the impression from a cursory glance at the media reports of this conflict that Iraq in the north is just devolving into chaos. That's not really true. What we're seeing is the rapid ascension of a new regional power called the Iraqi Islamic State, rather, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, depending on what media outlet you're looking at. Their technical name translates as the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, but because Americans say Syria and not the Levant, some news outlets are using the acronym ISIS instead of ISIL, but they are the same group.
The Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki insisted for a second straight day that security forces were capable of reversing the militants' gains. In a televised address to the nation, he pledged that Mosul, the largest city in northern Iraq, would soon be back in government's hands. This is just the latest round of fighting against ISIS, and it won't be the last, he says. Here in Washington, the State Department said the United States is expediting the delivery of critical weaponry to the Maliki government, but gave few details. Jen Psaki, the State Department spokesman, says, "You can expect we will provide additional assistance to the Iraqi government to combat the threat. Who could have seen this coming?
But it's very funny that Pentagon spokesmen are saying, we are largely, as far as combat is concerned, going to leave this up to the government of Iraq.
Now, there has been some threats of drones, though.
Only on Iraq would you hear the Pentagon say, this is an internal matter for them to deal with to any extent. Normally, you wouldn't hear a statement like that because we're so committed to interventionism, but the war in Iraq was so unpopular that you have Pentagon officials willing to make statements like this.
Well,
right, drones might be used, but again, it's not just in Iraq. We're seeing what members of Al-Qaeda and the founders of Al-Qaeda, like Osama bin Laden, would celebrate as the beginning of a supranational Islamic State in the Middle East. Their changing of their name to the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant represents their establishing themselves as a new and independent power. This group now controls all of northern Iraq, as well as eastern Syria, including large parts of Syria's northern border with Turkey. So it's very powerful.
Very powerful. And here we find this interesting juxtaposition of the United States government having to look at this from a global perspective, looking at this from an international perspective. This isn't just happening in Iraq. You understand, like Ian just explained, they control much of eastern Syria. But these are the same rebels that have been fighting against the Syrian government. So here they are, here the United States government, because of their interventionist foreign policy, we find ourselves having to support these same people in wanting to overthrow the government in Damascus, wanting to overthrow Syria, but not wanting them to overthrow the government of Iraq.
Right, remember just yesterday we literally saw MSNBC imply that you were an isolationist if you didn't want to arm the Syrian rebels.
Right.
And now we're talking about using drones against those same rebels in Iraq. And this is not ambiguous. I'm not equating all Islamic resistance fighters. This is one more or less unified coalition of Islamist resistance groups that controls a large swath of land, equivalent to the size of a small Middle Eastern country, now in eastern Syria and in northern Iraq. It is the same group that we are supporting, if indirectly, in Syria, and now discussing bombing in northern Iraq.
Is this really the consequences of our interventionist foreign policies, Ian? If so, why?
Well, partly. I think that we have given a lot of fuel to groups like this and helped them recruit. Now, bear in mind, when this may be difficult for older listeners or for you, Austin, to comprehend, but when Iraq was first invaded by the United States, I was 12. I know that's crazy to think about, but men my age in Iraq are going to be largely represented among fighters and people involved in combat. So what you're seeing now are people who grew up under American occupation, under foreign occupation, growing up with this resentment and this sense of hostility, now getting a chance to sort of run free and make their own way. And they're doing that by setting up an Islamic State. It's a backlash in the opposite direction. I also think that part of what's happening here is a realignment of borders. Iraq from the get-go was really an artificial state, and a lot of conflicts in Iraq, like Saddam's conflict with the Kurds, resulted from these cultural groups with contradictory cultural interests being stuck under one civic border artificially.
One of the biggest headlines in the energy world this year has been the revival of Iraqi oil output. In February, Iraq's production surged to an average of 3.6 million barrels a day. This is the highest level since 1979, the year that Saddam Hussein took power. Since Iraq has the world's fifth largest proven oil reserves, it has the potential to expand output much further, but political strife repeatedly has taken it away. The swift collapse of the Iraqi army in Mosul and other northern towns, and the advance of these militants towards Baghdad has shaken the country's stability, just as Iraq was starting to bring stability to the oil prices, to the oil markets. It looks as if the oil prices were unchanged on Wednesday. However, this morning they have begun to climb. Just after 8 a.m. this morning, the price of Brent crude oil, the international benchmark grade for delivery in July, rose to $111.94 a barrel, up $1.99 on the London-based commodity exchange.
And this new Islamic State may soon control that market. Mm-hmm. Remember, we're talking about in the media not whether this Islamic State will be defeated in northern Iraq, but whether they can be prevented now from taking over Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So I feel very comfortable in predicting that this Islamic State is here to stay for the near future, at least. So it's possible that they will expand and take over more territory in Iraq and then corner this market that's now emerging.
So far, the only oil-related casualty of the fighting has been the pipeline that runs from Kirkuk to Ceyhan in Turkey. Pipeline, which has been out of commission since March because of sabotage, was expected to be repaired and back online, carrying up to 250,000 barrels a day. That may be the only petroleum casualty right now, but the biggest oil fields are farther to the south, closer to Basra than to Baghdad, and the ISIS forces are trying to reach the supply lines, and right now the 2.5 million barrels a day exported via terminals and tankers in the Persian Gulf seem relatively secure. Robert McNally, who's president of the Rapidan Group, says that while not beyond ISIS's geographical reach, an effort to expand operations into southern Iraq would risk overextension, expose militants to the more determined defenders of southern oil infrastructure as well as Shia militia. What a mess. How in the world are they going to like say that they're going to be able to hold these Islamic fighters off from the south for long?
It's very unlikely.
How well protected is Baghdad, really? And I'm just curious, how willing is the president going to be after his extolling of his virtues of ending the war in Afghanistan and Iraq? What is he going to do now?
The war in Iraq was so unpopular, Bush left office with a 22% approval rating, and now President Obama is under pressure to oversee some sort of military action in Iraq. I want to make a related point here. I think one of the most important podcasts we've done was our podcast on Nigeria. Mm-hmm. You have some libertarians who, because they never really thought through their non-interventionism under Bush, are now coming up with these sort of thin emotional justifications for interventionism. There's a little cottage industry in the blogosphere now of the libertarian case for intervention. I've seen like 10 articles like that. I would like to say to those people, well, why not consistently apply that silly reasoning to Iraq? Don't you care about children in Iraq? Isn't the government supposed to protect the human rights of Iraq? Why are you not now for the war on Iraq? Mm-hmm. You must now adopt the foreign policy of George W. Bush to consistently apply interventionism. And I think that this is a nice teachable moment because Americans are really going to see that you cannot just externally re-engineer a culture and remake a country into a new political system from the outside as if it were some sort of Rubik's Cube that you could manipulate. We went in and for a decade tried to engineer Iraq into this modern secular democracy, but that's not what a lot of Iraqis at least wanted. And so now we're seeing the rise of a backlash in the opposite direction, the ascension of this Islamic State.
It begs one...
Despite all our effort, despite all the resources, all the blood, all the money, you can't do it.
It leaves one to wonder, from a libertarian viewpoint, whether or not people do better in some places with a totalitarian dictatorship rather than trying to impose democracy. Let me ask you that, Ian, because the question here is that if the alternative, the greater evil was going to be that we were going to have a caliphate in the Middle East, we were going to have a new Islamic State that arguably may be even more repressive to the fundamental civil rights that you and I adhere to, Western principles of law. Would it have been better to just have left Saddam Hussein in there? I mean,
well, it's a simple consequence of blowback, really, that if we decide we as outsiders are going to go in and impose democracy upon the Middle East, we're going to make a caliphate more likely. I think that's precisely what we've done. Mm-hmm. Again, one of my favorite Russell Kirk quotes, to seek for utopia is to end in disaster. That's precisely what has happened here. Mm-hmm. We have seeded a caliphate. These people see themselves as the beginning of a caliphate. And even if it's a relative flash in the pan, they're doing quite well. And they're showing that there is support in the Middle East for a supranational Islamic State. And I have no doubt, I don't think anyone could argue that this isn't the case, that that has happened because of excessive intervention in the Middle East. People are fired up. They want a reversal. They want to move in the opposite direction. And so they're willing to support these Islamic extremists.
Interesting. You know, President Obama made a vow to pull all American troops out by the start of 2012. National Security Agency Director Michael Hayden criticized that withdrawal as a mistake, saying, "Whatever the withdrawal means in purely physical terms in Iraq," Hayden wrote, The psychic impact there and in the region is that America is less interested. In Iraq, that means that each of the factions are going to their sectarian corners and are preparing to come out fighting. It sounds like he was right. A Defense Department official says that about $15 billion in equipment, training, and other services and firepower, and another $1 billion in arms and goods, including up to 200 Humvees, are on their way to Iraq. The DOD official says, "We are committed to ensuring that ammunition and equipment Iraq needs in its current fight are delivered as quickly as possible." To who, exactly? The government of al-Maliki? How can we be sure that these aren't going to fall in the hands of these militants?
Right, and now let's think through the implications of this argument here. If you think that the U.S. should intervene whenever there's conflicts of this sort, and you recognize that you can't just program people like robots and leave 10 years later and there'll be a modern democracy there, then the obvious implication is the U.S. should invade a country like Iraq and stay there endlessly. And we should do that everywhere. Every time we invade a country, stay there endlessly, because if we withdraw, something like this might happen, as in fact it is.
All right. Well, what do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Is Iraq on the brink of collapse? Was the mistake an issue of blowback, foreign interventionism? What do you think? Send us an email. Go to thelibertarianrepublic.com and tell us what you think about this story. And we want to know, do you like the podcast? Do us a favor. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you really like us, leave us a good review on iTunes. That really helps us out. And always come back every single day to your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at thelibertarianrepublic.com.